listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Martin Page.
Hi, Mike.
And next to him...
Oh my God,
he's here.
I'm speechless.
He's amongst us.
I don't know what to say.
He's arrived.
Well, I had nothing else to do, really.
Summerfield!
Bobby Summerfield is in the house.
You
Bobby.
Are terrible. Oh, you love Bobby. It's lovely to be back with you girls.
And then across the table from him, we have Marvin Caesar.
Yay!
And then right next to him, we have Rob Arbiter.
Hello, Mike.
Vicodin Rob.
Yeah, not this time.
Rob, this is show number two where you're not on any medication.
I know. It's exciting.
Welcome back, Bobby.
Thank you, my mates. Nice to be back. Sorry to be such a flake.
That's okay. We know you were working.
Yeah. No, I wasn't. I was actually out of work. I was pounding the papers looking for gigs.
Well, it's great to have everybody here. I know Scott, he's out finishing a mix.
Yeah, today's the last day of a mix on a film, which he should be able to talk about real soon.
Yep. And that generally means last day usually ends up hours.
We should mention we have our engineer back as well. I'm the best-looking engineer in the world.
April, yes. April's back.
April!
Our producer slash engineer.
Exactly.
And then I know Andrew, he's still in his top-secret project, which we'll be able to talk about when he gets back.
That's right. He'll be back.
There's a lot of top-secret.
It's like CIA.
A bunch of audio experts.
Can't FBI. Tell anything. Mustn't tell anybody anything.
Well, I would tell you what I've been doing, but I'd have to shoot you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Follow that, Mike.
I don't know how to follow that one, so I'm not going to. We're just going to move on. So, guys, since the last podcast, NAB happened over in Vegas, and I know, Marvin, I know you were there.
Yes, I was.
And I know you were there, Bobby.
I was indeed.
And so why don't you, let's start with you, Bobby. Why don't you give us a little synopsis on NAB and what you...
Well, it was in Vegas. Next. it was actually great. It was amazingly how big it's getting. Every year it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I'm talking about NAB.
Oh, we're back on that, are we?
No. The official numbers were it was the third highest attendance in history.
Wow.
So
because Bobby was there. I mean,
exactly.
He had his entourage with him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was 30% of the people, yeah.
Hey, do you think it was so crowded because of the 2009 deadline that's coming up where all the broadcasters have to switch off their analog and go all digital?
No, I don't think that's it. If anything, it would have been even more crowded if the East Coast wasn't closed on Sunday. The Sunday before the NAB, there was the big storms in New York and nobody could get out. So a lot of people that I was expecting to see from the East Coast couldn't even get there.
Was it a good show for you?
It was amazing. It was an amazing show. Quality people. It very different feeling from a NAM show.
People could speak English. Three less words in a row. That's what they're
right. Also, you should reintroduce Marvin to anyone who hasn't heard the earlier podcast or doesn't know him.
Are there people that haven't heard the earlier podcast?
I would imagine there might be.
It's hard to believe that. Actually.
Marvin Caesar is the president and founder of Apex.
That's right.
Yeah. He's also Apex also sponsors the Audio Nowcast, and he's generally just a great guy. So,
and I actually, you know, at NAB, I did go past Marvin's booth, and he was real busy, but his partner, I suppose, or his assistant showed me all their hardware, and I've got to say, and I'm not just saying it because you're here, that the mic we're talking through now is a really flexible little VO and / podcast and anything.
What was a real compliment to me was that Broadcast Engineering magazine, which is a TV magazine, picked the 230 as one of the top picks of the NAB show as a TV product.
Wow.
So people are recognizing it as how wonderful it is for TV production.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, since we've been using it, it makes it a lot easier to post, you know, the shows, and B, it just, everybody sounds a lot better than they really do in real life.
I love it.
So any cool gear though, Bobby, did you see anything there?
I mean, you know, I didn't really go for any of the hard gear. I just went to for the libraries, music libraries and the music side of things. But there was a lot of stuff. I went over to Euphonics, checked that out, went up to Apple, checked that out. Went to Vista and fell asleep. I didn't really.
Was Microsoft there?
Yeah, I think they were.
What was interesting is Google was there.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
They're doing a lot of advertising, obviously. They're getting more and more into the broadcast market. They're selling advertising for radio stations, which is pretty amazing.
That's pretty cool. When you were looking for the music libraries, were you looking to maybe do some more composing? Because I know you've composed for some music
definitely
libraries.
I have worked for quite a few of them that were there, and I went to see them because most of them are my mates, basically. I went there to see them and just hang out and say hi and just see how they're doing. And the nice thing this year, for what I think it was the first time actually, they put they grouped them all together. So they were all within like a cell sort of thing. So you could walk from one to the other, pick up all the swag and go to the pub.
Is that business, is that really booming? Is that really growing?
It's a massive business. It's getting much bigger now. Part of the reason I went there as well, because they had it's called a PMA. It's a Production Music Library Association meeting. And I like to hear what they're doing, because ASCAP and BMI and those societies are starting to respect more what music libraries give to the air. You know, I mean, a lot of it was crap many years ago. Not that long ago, actually. But now you start seeing bigger publishing companies like the EMIs and the big guys come in and start buying music libraries, because there's a big body of music that they can get royalties on, unlike any other music, pop music, unfortunately, these days. It's pirated.
You said a key word, which was royalties.
Yeah.
People are going to start making much more money now that every podcast has to pay per listener on each piece of music.
Right. And that's really what it is. That's why, you know, libraries are starting to become more of a respected field of business, as opposed to just crap.
Didn't Mike write the theme music to this podcast?
I think he did.
I think he did. So.
Actually, can we play it again?
Yeah, so for both of us.
He is turning up in a Rolls Royce.
I don't think the royalties are quite that high.
So he stole it.
No, I noticed the nice tricycle parked outside.
But it had an ASCAP sticker on it.
I just give myself $2 and that's it. Yeah. Well, you know, let me ask you, when you do music for a library,
it normally gets rejected when I do it.
Is there a life expectancy of the tune? I mean,
it depends what style you do, and that's a point to take into account when you do the music. Music libraries for anybody. Actually, since you said we're going to do Basic 101, maybe some people don't even know what music libraries are. Music libraries, just to clarify, are generally a purchased or a specifically manufactured, produced body of music in certain styles from right across the board for people in production to put to their video. So if you're doing a commercial and you think, oh, I really would like some rock stuff here and I can't afford to pay, you know, Nine Inch Nails or, you know, whatever the famous band that you'd want to get, they can get something very similar feel-wise doesn't rip them off, but something similar that would do the job, and they stick it in the background and they pay a small fee as opposed to $100,000 sync. So,
and now that the producers realize that there is such a huge amount of library music out there, they don't commission original music like they used to, whether it's for commercials or trailers or TV shows or whatever. It used to be that you'd always hire a composer to come up with music for your project, and now there's such a huge number of libraries, and they're massive.
Yep.
I mean, a library can have hundreds of thousands of
tons
in it.
And good stuff as well. I mean, there's a library.
You have to weed through it, but there's plenty of good stuff in there.
There's a library called V, which is relatively new, but they did it at Abbey Road in England, and there's a bunch of Brit composers, but not Hollywood hacks like myself. Proper guys that do.
You're not a hack.
Then you know I. they do like the real deal. I mean, they get, you know, big old orchestras in, and they do decent composition, and they write it and through write it, and they do good stuff, and they produce it really well, and it's as good as a film score, except not
let's not score to any particular picture,
and it's really good.
But you know what, a good music editor can take those cues and make it seem like it was scored for the picture.
And now more and more with the GarageBand on the Mac, I get so many music people come to me and say, hey, you know, I've done a temp track on my garage band. Do you think, what do you think? Can you fix it? Or, and I mean, that's just starting to become a thing. It's just happened twice now.
I'm like, really?
Wow.
Yeah.
And did you fix it?
Actually, one I did completely replace, and one I said, you know, something, you've done a great job. I think it's great. No, I've put myself out of a job, but it's true.
Wow.
It's interesting, very interesting.
So it was good to see all the guys that you work with and make some new contacts out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
absolutely.
Let me ask this, because we had talked about it, and there's been a lot of buzz about that Apple was going to make a huge announcement at NAB.
Right.
And I heard that they announced Final Cut Studio 2, right?
Right.
But was there any other big audio engine announcement or anything?
Other than they're rewriting Logic completely.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing about Final Cut Studio 2 is that in Soundtrack Pro 2, uh-huh. one of the cool things that they introduced is the fact that you can import OMFs now into it. And that's a killer feature, because it's really going to put it head to head with a lot of the Pro Tools stuff, because the fact that you can now import OMF, you know, the fact on LE we have to pay $1,000, you know, $1,200 to get DV Toolkit to get the ability to import OMFs.
And is it included free with the new soundtrack?
It's in the whole Final Cut Studio bundle, which is only like $1,200 or $1,400, somewhere around there. And I think the OMF import is really, really cool, because you can just see the writing on the wall, especially if Logic 8, you know, if it can incorporate some of the features that you can use in.
Are they really writing it from the ground up again, though? Because that's what
they said. So they said. I mean, I don't know whether it is, but that's what I heard from actually the guy that worked at the Macintosh.
But you know, speaking of Logic and.
You know what the acronym for Logic is, don't you?
What?
Lots of ghastly indirect crap.
No, you know what? This past weekend, I was.
I've got one for Cubase too.
Yeah, I'm sure you do.
Carry on.
I actually went back to working on some music, because I didn't have to work on anything, and so I dug into Logic. I said, you know what? I'm going to dig into Logic and write something on it. I really like Logic. I know you don't like Logic, Rob, but it just.
It's not that I don't like it. It's that I like other things more, because I, you know, I've lined them all up next to each other. And actually, truth be told, I just got the Logic 7.2 upgrade. I'd been using 7.1 for a long time, and I just, for $49, I said, let me get the latest version. So I do stay current with all of these, but when you line up all the different workstations and sequencers next to each other, and you read the manuals and you really learn how to use each one, you can make a good objective decision about what you like and don't like about each of them. And I have to say that I have tons of friends who use Logic and Digital Performer, but when I compare them side by side against Cubase, it's just still pretty.
It's a joke. It really
is. It's not even close.
You know what? I think you're right. I think Cubase does, and Nuendo does, definitely have some really great features, but I think bang for your buck with all the synths that they give you and the samplers that they give you in Logic.
Well, those are cool.
And the convolution reverb that you got. I mean, right off the bat, you could make music with just Logic.
You could. It'd take you a lot longer, but you could.
Well, yeah.
No, I tell you, Logic's strength is that its plugins, that the things that it comes with is brilliant. I love their plugins.
I agree with that.
That's why
I buy it.
It's a beautiful thing, and I actually use it sometimes as a standalone, because I really love their little plugs and their sampler and everything. It's really a great thing, but the actual sequencing interface and the audio recording of it is
aesthetic. Just archaic.
Absolutely.
It's like 10-year-old technology.
But what exactly? Because when I was sequencing, okay, you
how many tracks did you have going for starters? For example, in a true situation where a sequencer gets pushed to not the limits, but where you test a computer and a sequencer, you don't really just say, well, I've got 5 tracks and I do a couple of tracks here, 3 tracks of MIDI and 1 track of drums and 1 track of audio, do my voice and nah. That's like a very lot of people test a product out like that. And that's great. And Logic, anything would do that. You know, you use Cakewalk for that. That would do the job.
Right.
But when you have a good 250 tracks of template of MIDI tracks ready to go.
Okay.
And 40 stereo tracks of audio ready to go, locked a picture
right.
in all sorts of folders with a bunch of logical editors ready to go with quick keys that you can edit and process on the fly, because you have to get, you know, 2 minutes of music out the door in 8 hours. That is complicated from a production standpoint, meaning it's got rock in 4 seconds and an orchestral piece in another section, and you have to record a raw singer in the last part,
right.
And you've got to get it done in 8 hours.
I'm actually sweating hearing about this. It's terrifying.
No,
it's
but
like a nightmare.
I've never even worked with
no, but I'm just saying
half that minute.
Okay, but I'm
tracks.
Just saying yeah. That's the test.
Okay.
And what falls on its face is Logic. Logic sucks.
Why? Is it because of the
because
track
you can't
count?
Do it.
Because of the track
well,
count?
One, you can't, you know, specifically.
Yeah.
You can't organize the project window as well as you can in Cubase.
Okay.
You can't access the logical, it's called transformer in logic, but the logical editors without clicking and mousing and open up the window as you can in Cubase. So there goes a mouseless key stroke operation as opposed to, okay, well, I want to increase the velocity of this MIDI part. Well, let me just stop the sequencer. Or keep it going, but anyway, go down, mouse down, click down, open down, think. Five or six things you can't automate. It's like,
all right.
Well, also just the basic key editor window for the sequencer, the way you can have multiple, like many, key many sets. Tracks open within one window and edit them and pop between the multiple parts that you're editing at the same time and have as many controller lanes as you want. And it's pleasing to the eye. And it's, I mean, compared to, what do they call it? The hyper matrix or the matrix?
Hyper edit.
The hyper edit. Yeah. I mean, makes my eyes cross.
Wow. But yeah, but, I mean, just that sort of thing. You have your string section. 25 tracks, different bowing styles of strings, and they're all playing in different times. And you want to edit them all, but
in
you want
one
to see,
window.
In one window, you want to see. Okay, I want to make sure the arco strings are not playing when the micarta's playing, or the legato bits in the middle. Or I've got some trems that I want to bring in here. Like, okay, let's have a look at this. You're like, sorry, you can't see them all at once. Would you like to? Well, why? Well,
yeah, wait for Logic 8.
And then comes to the
wow,
audio.
I had to ask.
Should we start with the next thing?
Do you have an answer for that question, Bobby?
Sorry.
I mean, I was happy.
He was just beating around the bush.
I know. I was happy.
I'm sorry.
With my, like, you know, I got 8 tracks of MIDI
going. No, it's a lovely program. I mean, for that it is. It's great. But for real deal stuff.
So but I use it as a standalone to play its virtual instruments,
myself
and I'm
too.
Not usually disappointed there.
No, myself too. Exactly.
The one thing that bugged me about it, though, and I'm a huge Logic fan because I just thought it was really easy to get making music really quick, you know, with the way you could, you know, drag the looping and just loop sections and things like that. But loading up their sampler, the EVS 24.
ESX24.
You know, when I first started loading up samples on that, it took me about 5 minutes just to load one patch. And I couldn't figure out why. And finally I went on the board and what I had to do is I had to open up the project manager and then I had to define the file types for that particular sampler. And then it had to look, it was just ridiculous.
You may have been importing a different format though.
No, it was the stock loops. It was the stock samples for that sampler. After I read the post that was on the board and how to do this, they loaded up really quick. But for some reason, every time I loaded the samples, yeah. It scanned my whole computer looking for those samples.
I'm not even slightly surprised.
So that
there's a lot of stuff like that.
That was a little, but
you know what always puzzles me as well, to interrupt you real quickly, is that so many of my mates do use Logic, and I say, oh, that's great, you know, use Logic, and they say, yeah, I really love it. Then I run Pro Tools in the background to record my audio. I think, let me think about that for a minute. Why? I mean, it doesn't make sense. With a Cubase or a Nuendo, you have a smoking audio application. You really do. A smoking audio application with far superior mixing than Pro Tools has, and a better sequencing than Logic has. And it's like, and it's cheaper.
But you know what? I can see why those guys like it though, because there's a certain organic feeling. There's a certain thing about Logic that
they like it because they learned it first.
That's right.
And they're making money with it.
Yeah. Well,
and also a lot of them are lemmings. They just say, everybody says, what's the best sequencer to get? And they go, Logic, because somebody thinks Logic.
Well, I will say this. When people ask me what sequencer to get, I always say get what your friends have because they can answer your questions.
You know, and that's really... Don't get what I've got because I'm not answering.
Yeah, right, because I'm busy.
But, you know, I learned Sonar, Pro Tools. I even have a version of Cubase. And there's something kind of sexy and kind of cool about Logic. I don't know what it is, and it may not... You know, I'm not a power user, so I don't know all the different things, but... Whether it's the interface and the way it works and just how the flow, it was quite an enjoyable experience. Much more than Sonar, because I tried Sonar and
little program though, Sonar.
Sonar sounds great. Sonar sounds good, but it just didn't
but it's great. It really isn't, but it is good.
But it just didn't captivate me the way that Logic did.
I've changed over to Logic twice in my life and spent about a month each time really redoing the whole thing, buying the first thing,
right.
Hiring a super dude to come over and teach me the power user tricks because I didn't want to bother learning it all.
Right.
He left after about 4 hours. He's like, well, I can't do that. I'm like, oh, next. I swear. And I'm not lying. It cost me, it's a cost of time. It's not
Wow. Well, hey, we'll talk more about that later.
Also, I should point out, Bobby and I arrived at the exact same feelings about Cubase and Logic and all that stuff completely independently.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very
true. Completely independently.
But we do similar sort. We do the same sort of thing. We do track intensive, time intensive.
But we discovered all these things before we had actually become friends.
That's very true.
And we came to the same conclusion after years and years and years of the exact same experience.
I have a lot of mates, too, that do my job, have the same exact same thing, and we've come to the same conclusion. But, you know, it's a very.
Is this why Logic is changing now because of this?
No doubt.
Well, yeah. It's one reason.
Well, I think, you know what, if they can address some of the problems that they're having, not really problems, but the workflow issues, they can definitely become a contender. I'm looking at them, or any company really, to put up a good fight with Pro Tools. Even though I work on Pro Tools, 10 hours a day, and I love Pro Tools, it would be really nice just to get somebody who can, compete with Pro Tools on that level.
I think a lot of these companies like Logic, or formerly eMagic, doing
24.
Yeah, now being Apple owning it. But I think a lot of these companies, their main, I'm sure they would all like to be the Pro Tools killer, quote unquote, which people have been talking about for years. But yeah, the truth is,
we talk about that.
But the way they really stay in business is by keeping their current users happy, introducing new features that gets everybody to upgrade, and obviously still to add new users. But it's more like an incremental growth. It's not like we're going to become the Pro Tools killer with Logic 8.
Well,
I don't think they think that way.
I think Soundtrack Pro 2, I think it's a great step, and so we'll have to see what happens when they
Euphonics is doing with Nuendo, and the Euphonics control interface with Nuendo is very, very cool, and Yamaha's coming up with a very good little thing with them. So
I'll have to, we'll have to get Greg back on, and
There'll be new stuff to talk about.
Yeah, I have to have him talk about. Because speaking of Steinberg, they just released binary versions of Virtual Guitarist and Hypersonic 2, which are like two of my favorite plugins of all time. A little late in the game, but at least, better late than never.
I'd rather it works. I'd rather they fix it.
No, that's true. Especially Hypersonic, because that's such a great thing. Although it works great in Ableton, but for some reason in Logic, the sustain does not work with Hypersonic. I can't get the sustain to work at all.
Really?
And I've looked at all the controllers and all the other, little MIDI editors.
That's probably the main thing Logic 8's going to do.
sustain. Lasts longer.
That's right. I look at controller 64, and it's going from 0 to 127, and literally nothing's happening on Hypersonic.
You are such a geek.
I know.
That's
kind of just the fact that I know that. Hey, let's bring it back around to NAB. Marvin, did you introduce anything at the...
Wake up, Marvin.
Let's see, what did I introduce? Actually, we had two product rollouts. The big one, of course, was the Anaconda, which is no pun intended. It's not a pant snake.
Bobby's back. Bobby is back.
It's a 64-channel bidirectional snake, and we actually used it at the Stevie Wonder concert in December.
Right.
There were some minor things that needed to be done with it, and now it's all working. It's actually at KCET, the first installed unit, and it's been working for the last month and a half nonstop. So that's kind of fun.
How do they use it over at KCET? They run all their audio through it?
They run two 1788A remote-controlled preamps at their studio, and from the studio into the Anaconda, one end of the Anaconda, about 400 feet over multimode fiber to their control room, which is in another building.
Wow.
And from the Anaconda into their DM2000. And what's very, very cool about this, there's only about 40 microseconds of delay plus the speed of light. So what they can do is from the Yamaha pump audio back into the studio. Musicians play along with it. The live tracks come back and everything get mixed together without any problem from latency.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, so people are very, very excited about it. And
how far is their run from the
Theirs is only 400 feet, but this system can run a mile and a quarter.
That's what you had at your demo. Didn't you have like 5 miles of roll there or something?
No, no, no. We had 1,000 feet.
1,000 feet or something. It was kind of trippy.
Wow. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Well, that's what we used on the Stevie concert was 1,000-foot roll because it's all we could find. We had one day to get to find it. And luckily, friends were able to lend it to us. They only had 1,000-foot roll, but it worked great.
Wow. And what else did you?
The big thing that got a lot of attention was the headphone amp.
Which is a great-sounding headphone amp, by the way.
Well, that's the point. It's absolutely featureless other than great sound. And
It was loud.
It's loud, and what people really liked is they could turn up the level, and the bass still stay up there. Right. It didn't disappear.
Right.
And it didn't fall apart. It was great sounding. I got a lot of different feedback from various dealers, whether or not they would actually be able to sell it, which would be probably double what we're listening to right now. But obviously, this is what we're listening to right now is somewhat of a standard, and everybody knows what it is. It's just a throw-down tool. And I just went, what the hell? I'll do it. And so we're going ahead and manufacturing it. What was interesting is that anybody who listened to it said, hey, I'm not sure if I could sell it, but I certainly want one for myself.
That's the thing.
If you hear it, you're going to want it because it's not like they're going to be, you know.
You're much too naive. How long have you been selling audio?
Obviously not long enough.
There was one headphone, actually, system I saw, which is not like yours at all, but I really liked. There was, I think it's the Yamaha, it's an A2. It's a 16-channel. Each musician gets their own
mix,
and they can choose solo mute and change the volumes of what you know of 16 right. buses. Which is
it an analog system or digital?
It is analog system. Yeah. Well, it's actually Cat 5, but it's
right. I use the Furman, which is like that analog over.
Isn't that Axiom? Isn't that the manufacturer?
Avion. Avion is a
Avion.
System that is a monitoring system.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good. It sounded quite punchy too.
Would you ever use that in your studio?
I was actually thinking of getting one. I'm thinking of getting one.
Because how do you do it right now on your board? Do you have to just
don't, them, don't have headphones. They don't play. They don't. I just wave. No, I got to.
Even when people aren't there.
Yeah, but only. No, I got a Behringer system. I got like crap. Yeah, I know, but it's you know it's good enough for the job. Actually, and I got four little things. Behringer really sucks. It really does. But it's, you know, that does the job for. I wanted to get the Hear system, but they didn't have enough features on it.
Yeah, I've been using the Furman system for a long time. It just gives you basically four mono volume knobs and one stereo. And it's cool for a little system. I usually have 5 or 6 headphone boxes hooked to it, and everybody can do their own mix. And I've heard good things about the Hear system, but when you actually have to put it into a facility that's spread out, because it's a digital system, you can't split the signal somehow the way you can with the analog systems, and there were a few things that just made it not workable.
Yeah,
it's cool that it's digital, but yeah.
The A1 system. I don't even remember the Axiom, is that called?
Avion.
Avion. Okay. The Avion system has got presets, which are really nice. So
wow.
You can do a run-through with the guys and say, you know, okay, you got it? And they, yeah, great. So they just hit and hold the button, and it stores their setup for them.
Wow, this does not sound cheap.
Actually, not bad.
Really?
It was, it wasn't bad. I think about $3,000 for a big studio, like eight
for how
boxes.
Many? 8 boxes?
Yeah.
Actually, that's not.
That's not too bad. Hey, well, thanks for the roundup of NAB, and I know we got a little bit off topic there, but we're going to take a break now. When we come back, we're going to talk Gear 101. So stand by, and we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the L.A. area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And in this segment, guys, I want to talk about... I've actually got a lot of emails, and people have asked that we kind of discuss some of the tools that we use. But explain it to a lot of beginners that are out there, because there's a lot of beginners that listen to us. So I thought it'd be a great idea if we just take some of the tools and we explain what they do and maybe give some hints and tips as to what the individual pieces of gear does.
Hmm.
So first thing I want to start out with is, let's start right at the top, with the microphone. Guys, anybody want to say anything about microphones? Bobby?
Yeah, well, I mean, for beginners, you said, so just obviously needless to say, everybody knows what a microphone is, but it's the thing that people sing in or put in front of an instrument to record. And what that does is converts acoustic sound to electricity, and then you record it. So that's the basic thing of what a microphone does. It's not digital. All microphones are actually acoustic, electromechanical. That's basically what they are. They're a physical moving membrane that moves in a magnetic field mostly and creates electricity. Then it gets turned into digital at a later date. But anyway, to keep it simple, there are a bunch of different microphone styles of manufacturers, of course, and there's different kinds of microphones. But most common are dynamic microphones and condenser microphones are the two most common. And the biggest difference between the two of them, other than certain sounds and styles, is that the dynamic microphone is a microphone that doesn't need, for a simple way of looking at it, a microphone that doesn't need a phantom power or any electricity to run. It's purely like a guitar pickup. And the best example of what a dynamic microphone is the opposite of a speaker. When you see a speaker like a NS10 or a one single speaker, it's a cone that moves when electricity gets sent to it. A microphone, a dynamic microphone, is exactly that, except in reverse. Instead of having a speaker, it has a little diaphragm, which is very sensitive to air movement. And then if there's a sound close to it, the diaphragm moves in relation to the air movement and converts into electricity. And basically that's the concept of a dynamic microphone.
And you most people are familiar with the Shure 57, which is probably the world's most popular dynamic microphone.
And that's the microphone that is like gray with a little silver.
Yeah, that's generally the SM58 made by Shure. Very good microphone. A very hardy microphone. You know, the Who proved that for many years. Roger Daltrey swinging it around his head on a 50-foot mic cable. That thing kept on working. They keep on working. And you know, they haven't really changed much in design. Certainly, they haven't changed in electronic design since they were invented, pretty much.
Tell me a couple of your favorite microphones. Like what
dynamic microphones?
Yeah, any kind. When you're we're gonna track
vintage 557s, 58s, 57s as well.
When you track vocals in your
Beyers 802. Dynamic microphones.
It doesn't have to be dynamic, any microphone.
It really depends on the style of the voice and what gender it is and what key it is in and whatever. But you know, a condenser microphone is very good for a quick cheat sheet, so to speak. Condenser microphones are generally better for higher, faster, transient instruments. So if you're going to record a shaker, it's best you would get a better response, meaning it would be able to record the very fast slew and fast transients of a high instrument, a quick starting instrument like a shaker or a cowbell. A condenser microphone would do a better job for that. So to answer your question, to sing for the singer, God, favorite microphones. I love a 67, Neumann 67. I have one. I have a 47 rather. I like that too. I do like some of the 87s, Neumann stuff. I like some of the AKGs, the older stuff. C12s, very good. 4007s. There's just a lot of different microphones. But favorite one, I think, possibly one family would be the Neumann family.
What?
I think.
That's great. That's a really popular one. I like
that. Yeah, it's popular. It's become more popular because everybody thinks it. But it really is a good microphone.
Rob, do you have a favorite microphone when you track vocals over your place?
Actually, it depends on the singer because
what does Stevie use with his voice? Because his voice has it's a little sharp and he tends to.
Well, you know what, he's used different mics through the years, but if you go back to his classic recordings, from the 70s, I was a child at the time, but I know that he actually did a lot of his vocals with an RE20, which is an Electrovoice mic. And most people think of it as an instrument mic, but it's still a really great mic for vocals. And we use that sometimes.
It is the most popular mic for radio broadcasts because it is so easy to work.
You can't get too close to it either.
No, you can't really blow it up. It just always sounds good. But most people don't think of it as a pristine singer's mic kind of mic, because it really isn't, but it just has a great sound. And if you're recording anything where the singer really needs to push, it won't distort in an unpleasing way. It's really nice to record with. If we're recording a singer with a real pure voice and we want to do a clean recording, we'll usually use one of the Neumann tube mics, like a 149, something like that, or, you know, like you said, the C12s are great for that. But a lot of times we will on purpose try the wrong mic if we're recording an instrument more than a vocal, because a lot of times you'll just get a sound you weren't anticipating and it might be a new cool sound.
It's true.
We've recorded vocals through a little harmonica mic. I forget what model it is.
That's the Green Bullet 50.
The Green Bullet, yeah. And that's just an amazing sound. It doesn't sound super clean or, you know, full frequency or anything, but it sounds really good.
That's a very good microphone for putting in a kick drum. It's a great microphone for exactly what Rob says. Use microphones incorrectly is once you've learned how to use them correctly, maybe.
Right.
It's a great way. You don't have to. I'm actually not stodgy in that respect. I'm like, well, whatever, get the sound. Get something creative, whatever. But just be careful when you do have high output instruments like a bass drum or a snare drum. If you put a very pristine condenser mic too close to it, you can blow it up and damage it completely. Put a ribbon mic inside a bass drum, you'll most probably just blow the mic up.
You got to be careful with ribbons that you don't break the ribbon. It's very fragile. So if you put a ribbon mic in front of a singer who happens to cough, like I've done about 10,000 times tonight, you'll just blow it up. Wow. It'll be gone.
Also, storing a ribbon microphone is very important. You mustn't store it lying down. You must store it standing up. Otherwise, the ribbon itself is like a piece of like a crinkly paper, except it's tin normally, let's just say. And really? It will start to sag over time.
Really?
And then the frequency...
I've got to go.
I've got two ribbon mics right now. You know, that's so funny you say that, because I bought a ribbon mic and it was...
I laid it down and never worked again.
But it came in a box. It came in a wood box that it laid down flat, and you open the lid up and it's right there flat. Now I got to go...
Yeah, I mean, you know, long-term storage, I'm not talking about leaving it overnight or a week, but I mean, over time, that ribbon cable, it would start to get limp and
other thing that people should be aware of is you never put any phantom power on a ribbon. That'll blow it up.
That will blow it up too.
And whereas you can apply a phantom on certainly you need it for a condenser, but you could put it on a dynamic and it won't hurt it,
yeah.
Wow, that's good.
And then
to know.
There's different styles of patterns, but we could go in for hours about that.
Well, actually, we should touch on the patterns a little bit.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, the pattern of the microphone basically tells you where it's picking up sound around its circumference. So the most common pattern you'd use for vocal is called the cardioid pattern, and the easiest way to describe it is it usually looks like an upside down heart or like a little. Most of the mics we have, when you have a cardioid pattern, the singer has to sing at the little
I'm going to demonstrate the cardioid microphone pattern to you.
Let's do
I'm
that.
I'm talking in a cardioid microphone in the front. Now I'm going to talk at the side. Now I'm talking at the back, and you don't really hear it. And now you hear my fingers in front of it. Sounds really good. You hear all the treble. Go around to the right. Go behind it, and you stop to hear the treble. And it's called the rejection stage. That's called a cardioid pattern.
So you want the singer to sing into the part that's actually picking up sound. It's amazing how many times I've seen singers singing into the wrong side of the mic, and it just doesn't sound really good.
Especially the 414s. I don't know why. Everybody seems to sing on the black side. It's like, dude.
There's nothing there.
The other side.
Unless it's in a figure eight pattern, which means it's picking up from the front or back. But the pattern, just to say, usually the microphone will have pictures on it of what its pickup pattern is, and if it's a mic that has a switchable pattern, you just flick a little switch. And the same mic can be used sometimes cardioid or omnidirectional, which means it picks up all the way around, or figure eight, which means it picks up in the front and the back, but not on the sides. And always make sure you have your pattern set right and you're performing into the right side of the mic.
Well, that pretty much covers microphones. Although I will say, Martin, you've got a lot of microphones over your place, and you're really particular about recording your vocals. What do you look for when you pick out your microphone?
Well, I'm obviously coming from a different place here. I've learned a lot from just listening, but I've had a lot of time to, you know, have different microphones in the studio when I'm singing, and I'm really coming from that place where it sounds the best for you, you know. And then I got into collecting a few, because for different songs, as Bobby said, for different keys and different attitudes, you would, I would probably have a selection of three or four that I really liked. It does come down to the singer, you know, checking on how he, how the microphone probably would help him. Or even, one of my favorites is a Neumann 87, which I've had for years. And it actually adds something to my voice, which I quite like. And so it definitely isn't absolutely pure. But then on ballads, I've got a beautiful, B&K mic, a very thin, like pencil mic. I'm not sure of the number. And that is incredibly intimate. And I always pull that out for, you know, for the ballads and for songs that are very intimate. And the 414 has always been really reliable when you're doing guitars. And also, when I was working with Phil Collins, he would like to sing with the Beyer mic.
Yeah, the handheld.
Yeah, the handheld. And it's
508, right? I think.
Yeah, it's got a lovely woolly tone to it. And I used that on my last album on a song called "I Was Made for You," and I used it as a guide vocal. But then it just had such a tone to it. And of course, Phil said to me that he has quite a toppy, bright voice, so this Beyer would definitely round it off a little bit. But my favorite all round I've got is really. Oh, I do have that. Is it a C12
or C11? AKG?
Yeah. And it's
sort of a tall tube
shaped
thing.
That's a beautiful mic, and Bobby's been telling me that I should really get into that. But again, another thing is I was able to get good preamps, you know, the Massenburg preamp and Neves, and that certainly does complement these great microphones.
Well, let's move on to preamps really quick. Let's talk about a really good preamp. What are some of your favorite preamps, and how important is it to the to the signal path?
Again, you know, if you're talking with it, ask me or anybody, I suppose.
Anybody.
I'll just jump in. A mic preamp, again, all these pieces of audio gear that you're talking about, analog audio gear, has specific characters, and they marry a certain way, or they interact a certain way with different microphones because of the impedance of the microphone preamp. That's the resistance it has to the microphone being plugged in, for want of a better word. So you have these mic. Some mic preamps will work better with some microphones than others. That's definitely one thing. And all microphone preamps have their own character, whether good or bad. I've just asked the Marvin, I said, what's that 230 sound like on instruments? He's like, well, it's actually not, we wouldn't design it for that. I was like, no, I want to try it on that, because that's really kind of like the mad scientist attitude you should have when you start to become a recording engineer, for real recording engineer.
I think I jump in what Bobby's saying there with the Beatles records. You know, if you go back to, if you read a lot of what the Beatles were doing, the engineers were experimenting all the time, and they were taking out microphones out of the closets, which were used for classical music, and putting them in front of amplifiers. And some of the sounds were, you know, nobody had heard that kind of sound before, because it wasn't really done the right way. And Jeff Emmerich, sorry, his new book, he was talking about that he was one of the first engineers to put the microphone very near the kick drum. And then suddenly another sound appeared altogether, you know, and mass compression of the cymbals. But I like to do that not knowing what I'm doing. I mean, I'm very naive about this. I got the basics under my skin, but I like to put the wrong microphones in front of guitars and then record it, and then put the right microphone on and just listen to it and check out what the song's supposed to be saying, and what its magic is and what its atmosphere is. And sometimes it's really better to use the wrong things, you know, when you look at the song, because it can just give it character.
I'm actually a big fan of doing lead vocals on, you said Stevie did that, but I love using the dynamic mics on a singer, but when they can actually sing into the mic and actually hold it, not so much for the shake noise, but you get such an attitude, it's really, really great.
You two are very much that, wasn't you two in the control room.
Oh, Mick Jagger used to do his vocals, I think, on a 58 in a control room or something, was it? And, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool. Hey, Marvin, from a manufacturer point of view, when you were designing your mic pre, what were some of your goals? How did you want to, you know, shape the sound? How did you want to make that microphone really, really sing?
Our goal in our tube-based mic pre's was size. And for the same electronic level, our preamps, our tube preamps, are much more present and bigger sounding than any other preamps. And so much so that when we demonstrated against other preamps, we had to develop a switch box so that people could actually compare level to level and then listen, because invariably people were pushing our preamps down in level to match the same presence level. And rather than me talking about, bragging about our stuff, I should let Rob talk about how he used our preamps.
I've never used your preamp.
That was short.
No, I actually, I think that different preamps can be as meaningful as different microphones, depending also on the features of the preamp. Some preamps are very kind of featureless, and they just sound good, and they're a real clean chain. But there are other preamps that have a bunch of features and let you really change the sound. But I have a bunch of preamps, and when I first checked out the Aphex 1100 Mark II, I guess it is, and this is way before I ever met Marvin. It was just in a vacuum. A friend said, you should check these out. They sound great, and I listened to them, and the presence and the clarity of it was pretty amazing. And it really, we happened to be at a time when we were recording a lot of acoustic guitar and a lot of real clean vocals, and the hype I had heard was that you could record something through this preamp, and then it would sit in a mix better, and it wouldn't have to be as loud to be present in the mix, which I thought was total sales hoo-ha. But on the first time we ever used it was on an acoustic guitar, and I'm trying to think what we used. Well, I shouldn't say what we used as the previous mic pre, but I don't actually remember. We had been recording the guitar, two mics through a stereo mic pre, and then we switched to the 1100, and it's not that the sound was all that different. I mean, the previous mic pre we'd been using was very expensive and very good, but the recordings with the 1100 just sat in the mix a lot better, and they did sound as if like a layer of gauze had been taken off the sound. It just was more present and more just clear, more like what it sounded like in the room live. And in my studio now, I have a bunch of different flavors of mic pre, and I have some that purposely color the sound. You know, they have tube stages that aren't well done, and so you get a whole bunch of tube noise. And I should also mention, you know, when it comes to tubes, there's a lot of voodoo out there about, should I buy something with tubes? Does everything have to have tubes to sound good? And the truth is, tubes are a sound in today's gear. And a lot of people would say if you use a tube microphone with a tube mic pre, you get too much tubiness. But maybe that's what you're going for. I think in any well-rounded studio, it's good to have your channels that you think are super clean and your other channels that you think add something very noticeable and pleasing. And the Aphex 1100 for me is definitely on the clean, present side. If someone's coming over to record something really pristine, that's definitely one of the ones.
I will say with the mic pre, that's probably one of the best places that you can invest, you know, go for the quality piece of gear to really make a difference in your sound, especially if you're tracking in your, you know, your little Pro Tools LE system. You know, you get a really good mic pre and you capture that sound with a great mic pre, it's going to raise the quality of your recording.
Can I make a very important point here? We're talking about outboard preamps. Right. We sell outboard preamps. So many people take our output and put it into another preamp. And okay, that's, we can laugh about it, but what a lot of people do is put it into what they think is a line input. In their consoles, it says line in. The problem is those line in, when you have that switch for line in, all that's doing is putting a pad in front of the preamp. And so there's so much confusion out there. If you're going to invest into a high-quality outboard preamp, make sure you're going into an insert point into your console. Or if the preamp has a digital out, use the digital out into your record.
Or better still, go into A to D if you can. The best chain is to actually bypass your console completely.
Well, that's a good idea.
That's the only way to go, really, if you're going to do real record. You know, like, of course, if you need facility for insert points, but get rid of the console, just take mic pre out straight into.
And if you're using an interface box that is being powered by USB, you can't expect that to be a high-quality analog interface. Make sure you use a digital interface going into that interface box.
Yeah, that's a good point.
No, that's really true, because when I was doing some testing of the API A to D, we ran it just through the SPDIF on a Pro Tools LE system, and it just made all the difference in the world, you know,
because
you
compared can really, to what?
Compared to just running it into the, coming out of the, since it has a built-in 312 mic pre, you can come out of the mic pre, bypass the
analog,
digital, and go analog into into the Pro Tools.
Right.
Boy, you use the digital and you go SPDIF, it makes
it should
all,
be like night and day.
It is. It's night and day. So,
But I can't tell you how many people do that, and we actually had to start putting into our boxes that we shipped the 230 in warning labels. With, and what we did was we actually had a schematic of an expensive console, that the front end of a console showing it's that it's labeled line in going right into the preamp.
Wow. Wow. That's almost kind of deceptive if you really think about it.
That's what the design, though, is just a 600. It's a different impedance.
Yeah, it just means line level. It doesn't actually mean it's...
Yeah, it's, you know, the same, it's same op amp. It's just got a, it's got a, it's got a T-pad on the thing.
Well, let's move on. We've hit the mics. We've got the preamps. Let's talk about... here's one where there's a lot of confusion out there, and this is the dynamic processing. We're talking compressors, gates, limiters. All right, guys, well, let's just open it up. Anybody want to... talk a little bit about some compression?
I've taken it all, so somebody
else.
I think it's real important to get definitions in order that we all talk the same language. So you have different categories of gain reduction. And you talk about ratio, you talk about time constants, and you talk about thresholds. The higher the ratio, that's the compression ratio, how many dB input does it take to have 1 dB more of output? And you talk about time constants, how fast the attack time, how fast the release time. The faster the time constants, the higher the ratio, the more the effect on the audio. So what you want to do is when you have high ratio, fast time constants, you want to set the threshold very high. And you want to do the more gentle processing, which is lower ratio, slower attack times, you could set at the lower threshold. So
just to interrupt you real quickly, because it's 101. I just want to just put a little thing in for people that are listening. A compressor you're talking of, or dynamic control. A compressor is a piece of hardware in our situation that reduces the volume of the signal coming into it proportionately to its signal set by a knob. It's called the ratio, which Marvin's explaining. But you can basically say, all the volume's coming in, I want you to cut it in half and just give me half the volume out, but keep the dynamics as it is coming in, swinging up and down. I want it to stay intact, but I just want the dynamic swings to be lower. That's how Marvin's. I just wanted to say that because if somebody listens, they can't help.
Great.
Well, the idea is the threshold is where that action starts. You know, so if below threshold, it's a linear amplifier.
Hopefully.
Yeah, if it's well designed.
Right. So the idea is that you want to do your gentle processing first and then progressively get more aggressive. Aggressive being higher ratio and faster time constants.
Now, when would you use compression? What would be a good example of when you would use compression?
Well, for example, let's say we spoke about microphones and recording vocals. So let's just give us a real world situation. Say Martin's Page is singing a song, and I want to capture his voice, but he's singing a song that's soft in the verse and loud in the chorus, and the dynamics of his voice is far wider than the microphone. Well, it's not the microphone, but at least my recording chain can take. I would put a compressor on that microphone's chain before it goes to what I'm recording. So I would protect the dynamic swings. I'd reduce the dynamic swings. So that's when I would record, use a compressor to compress. The word implies what it does by a factor, by a ratio, the amount of dynamic, how loud and soft Martin would sing. So if he goes,
so it evens it out.
It's an evener.
It's a great little evener.
And depending on what you're trying to even out, you know, the human voice, usually is a pretty smooth thing. You know, it doesn't have like a sharp smack like a snare drum or
especially, you know, Andrew's voice.
Yeah, that's true.
His voice smooth is really smooth.
That's why he's not here tonight. He's pimping. I'm pimping.
But if you're recording like a bass guitar, an electric bass, right, is a good example of something that has a really long sort of uniform smooth sustain once the note is plucked or smacked. But that initial smack has a huge transient with it, and a compressor is a way, because if you didn't have a compressor, you'd have to turn down the sound of the bass so that its attack didn't distort. So with a compressor, you'd have to have a pretty fast compressor, but you can have when that first hit happens with the bass attack, you can have it slam down the level, and then as the bass sustains, as the note, you know, rings out, this the compressor would lighten up on it.
Biggest example of that is lead guitarist or something like that. You get a guitar amp, or you hear a guitar player when they strike like a solo note, and the thing just rings forever. It's not because, you know, it is because they obviously got a nice guitar, but also it's because the initial pluck is bang, and the actual note is reduced at the beginning, but there's a slow enough release time and enough compression that it sucks up. So as the natural decay of the note starts to decrease in volume, the compressor's threshold, the compressor starts to increase its volume output, so you get long sustains.
But the problem happens if you have too fast an attack time, mm-hmm. and then you get the pluck, it'll punch a hole in the audio. So you don't want to have that effect.
And it would also pump while the bass note is going.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, like Martin, being a bass player, how important is compression to you? I mean, what kind of compression do you use on your bass rig?
Well, I've got a Music Man bass, and I love to slap the bass as well as just to play with the fingers. So I do what you guys are talking about. I find a really nice level on the compressor so that I can slap the bass, and also if I'm going to play quietly, it'll lift it up. But I'm fortunate to have, and also the Music Man bass, it has that kind of feel to it where it tries to control it already. But
sounds compressed already, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. They got an original sound to them, but they feel like that. But I'd put a Neve compressor across it, or a Teletronics. I've got one of the old ones, one of the old
tubes. LA-2As.
Yeah, and that's that. The LA-2A works just brilliant with most things that mm-hmm. are vocals and everything.
That's a leveling amplifier.
Yeah. Now that works very well for me in multiple situations.
And I'm trying to find another pair of them. So anybody out there who has an original
LA-2A,
they're pretty rare.
Yeah. Well, let me bring something up. The plug-in compressor versus the hardware compressor. What are the pros and cons of using those? I find that the plug-in compressor, when you're really having to slam a compressor, sometimes the bottom, the low end, it's
crap.
My mind would break.
Not real?
It's a little artificial. It's a little fake, and you don't really know what's happening. Whereas if you have like a real compressor, like if you're doing like a 525 with like the bass and you're really slamming it, it's really musical, and the pumping that you can get is actually, it's actually a desired effect, as opposed to trying to, when you're pumping a plug-in compressor, it's just not real. It's just this fake thing. And it goes,
I think the rule holds true with plug-in compressors as well as with a lot of other plug-ins and virtual instruments and everything else. The plug-in sounds absolutely great until you hear the real thing. So the plug-in is definitely fine to get work done, but when you actually compare like the plug-in LA-2A, which most people have for Pro Tools, compared to a real LA-2A, the plugin is great. I mean, it's very usable for a lot of things, but it's not the same thing.
No character, man. It just doesn't have character.
Well, that's the thing. I think it's so programmed to do, you know, digitally. Well, at this level, we're going to do this, and when you get this thing, we're going to do that. That it's not. It doesn't have that chaos that you get in a real analog piece of gear, where it just has that little thing on the low end. Especially.
Well, the worst thing about, to my ears, about plugins, compressors. Is that they use what's called look ahead. And that tends to take all the punch out of the signal. And so where a really good sounding dynamics processor, you still have that slap in front. It's gone in the digital,
processors. And to clarify what look ahead is for people that, you know, cause you're doing a basic 101, look ahead with an electronic VST plugin or electronics VST way of doing it, let's say, is when obviously in real world, if you have an instrument and the guy hits the bass loud, let's say, if you have an analog compressor sitting there in the chain, it's just waiting for electricity to come down the line. It's set to a certain way. It will compress whatever it sees come down the line. But when it comes down the line, it will compress when it sees it. It can't go and say, oh, he's going to play a C really loud, now let me go and compress it. It can't set its reference up. So the electronic compressor, because it's playing from hard drive, it knows what parameters to how to compress, and it knows that hard drive is playing this bass back at a certain in a couple of milliseconds. So it compensates for it. So sometimes you actually lose the front end distortion that analog compressor's sitting there waiting, and all of a sudden they go, oh, crap, it's a really loud sound,
right.
And it tries to reduce the volume of it, but it doesn't, and there's a very short transient that still sticks out and distorts, actually, if you look at it on the scope, but it sounds great.
That's yeah, what it's we, a great sound.
It's
right.
a great sound, but you can, you know.
Another thing I think we should bring up here is what Marvin was talking about in the break about the difference between compressors and limiters. I think lots of people find that really quite a hard one to work
well,
out.
Well, yeah, compressors are typically lower ratio and fairly slow attack and release characteristics. So you would use it to bring lower level signals up to smooth out a performance. A limiter has a high ratio and faster attack and release characteristics. So you'd have that at a higher threshold just to put a cap on everything. And the word protection is more appropriate to a limiter as compared to a compressor. If you're going to use a compressor to protect, you're so into the compressor that you're so deep, it's affecting everything.
Right.
Studio condom. Will you keep that in? I think that was sounding good.
No, you're not allowed to say condom. No. or titty bar.
Hey, I will say that...
good explanation.
That, one good thing about a plug-in compressor is that if you've never automated the threshold, sometimes when you automate a threshold, it can be a really great tool that you can use on a plug-in compressor that's really hard to use on
Let me just say, for people that like using AFX and other analog compressors, it's a very simple way of doing it, getting the look-ahead feature for it. You just get an audio track. Say, for example, you're sitting in your Pro Tools or whatever it is. You get an audio track of a bass, let's say. It's a good little trick, maybe not 101, but either way. Get a good little, get a bass performance. You say, oh, I really want to compress this, but I don't want to make the compressor so fast that it snaps off all the front end. So what you can do is you can duplicate that track, the bass track, let's say, for example, and move it ahead in time by, say, 5 or 10 milliseconds, and then use that bass track that's early not to be heard in the mix, but purely as a input to a compressor, which will be compressing the track which is playing the other track, which is playing in time.
What's he talking about?
You know what? There's a sidechain.
Yeah, let's say what sidechain is. Let's say what sidechain is, because a lot of people have seen sidechain on a lot of compressors and other gear and don't know what sidechain means.
And there's an audio path. That's the actual audio going through the compressor. And then there's a detector circuit, which normally is the audio itself. But you can, in some compressors, have another input that is sidechain into that key input, into the detector. And that's what we was talking about.
And you use that as the control of the
correct
of the compressor. And
right. So if you wanted to do, so if you said, "Oh, really? I love analog, but I can't. I want look ahead as well." You can get round it by, if you have it recorded, of course. You can't obviously do it in a live situation because you don't know what the guy's going to play.
Right.
But but if it's recorded, you can do it, and it's a common practice that we used to use many years ago. And
we should also another dynamics processor that we haven't talked about yet that also uses sidechain is gates. A lot of people have heard the idea of a gate, but don't know what a gate is.
Gate and expander, that's one we should get into, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, do you guys use gates and expanders?
Oh, all the time.
Yep. What do you use them for?
I'll keep the dog in.
It's good to have you back.
That's
Bob.
The gate. How to use an expander on the dog. Into that later.
There's the obvious where you know, if you're tracking drums and you want to keep everything gated so all the microphones
are. Well, explain what gates are to people first. You go for it, Mike.
No, I'm not going to go for it. Sorry. That's going to be you, Bobby. You're doing good.
Oh, here we go. A gate's basically a talking analog outboard gear, let's just say again. It's a piece of hardware that will open, meaning to say let audio pass through it, only when the audio coming to it is above a certain volume. So, for example, if I wanted to gate out the background noise of, say I'm talking here and somebody's running a tap in the background, water running, and I wanted to switch that off when I'm not talking, I would set the gate so that it would switch off when I'm not talking, and so you wouldn't hear the water running in the background. That's a silly example, but one of them.
See, Bobby, that was much better than what I could have done.
Well,
and you're here so rarely, I'm going to have you talking as much as
possible.
I'm
never coming again.
What was very amusing to me was hearing all these guys making fun of noise gates, and because they were all chattering, and the conventional gate does chatter, and there are solutions to that.
Set it correctly.
Well, no.
Actually, it's very difficult to set it correctly. If anybody here has set up a gate, and I guess you guys have, you're always adjusting the threshold along with the attack time. The higher the threshold, the faster the attack time. If you lower the threshold, you can have a more musical turn on and a slower attack time,
right.
But then you false trigger. If you have too fast an attack time, you create a wavefront that can click. So that's why people are always adjusting. For those of you out there knowing how to set up a conventional gate,
this is a perfect example of what we spoke about with compressors, about look ahead and, right. and side chaining, gating when it's on tape or when you're on a hard drive and you want to gate something. The only way, and use an analog gate, the only way to do it really is to look ahead. That's the best way to do it. But if you're using a live situation, put a microphone in a strategic spot closer to the instrument that will open earlier. We used to do that all the time when we used to cut drums. We used to have like 50 mics on the drum kit, literally 45 mics. We'd have drum triggers on the toms to trigger the MIDI, so we record that into a Mac. Then we'd have a microphone on the tom to trigger the gate, which would be right on the skin, and then we'd have a 421 or a microphone about half a foot away from the tom to record the recording of the tom. But the mic would be right on the skin just to open the gate or the piezo. There'll be like there's a little context. We used to put on the mics and we used to do that. If it wasn't too noisy and we didn't get false triggers, we used to use that square wave to trigger the gate to open.
Wow.
I should also
and then
mention
we used to replace it all with samples. Anyway.
Yeah, right, exactly. Another cool feature that some gates have is the ability not to just turn the sound off when it hasn't reached the threshold, but to just dim it down. You know, you could set how deep the gate can attenuate the sound. And actually that sort of becomes what an expander.
Well, a gate is high ratio, meaning that if the signal is 1 dB under threshold, it's attenuated 100 dB, or if depending on the depth, whereas an expander is a lower ratio, say 2-to-1 or 3-to-1. So it's more gentle. Normally you would use that if you were doing a voiceover, using the voice as a trigger, as a key input on a music track, and to push that music track underneath the voice and then let it fade back up or come back up when the voice was over.
We just use an expander like that a lot on a film I just mixed, where there was a lot of production dialogue that was recorded outside and there was a lot of just ambient noise around, but there was dialogue that would come and go inside the noise. And by setting an expander to basically use the voice as a threshold, we'd have it duck down all of the ambient noise around the voice until the voice would speak, and then it would open way up. But with a gate, you couldn't do that because when no one was talking, it would just be gone. But this ended up being just like riding the fader. Whenever someone would talk, it would bring up the overall level of the track. And it became like an automated fader ride for the dialogue, and it really saved a lot of time.
The truth of the matter, though, with a gate, just to clarify, you can actually set the depth of it. On the better ones, the Dromers and the 612. What was it? 512.
The 622. The 612 was the one that I bet $10,000 you couldn't find a better one. If you remember
I didn't know you did. That was a great.
Yeah, actually, the first ad was I bet $2,500 you couldn't find a better gate, and people thought the gate cost $2,500. So I crossed that out and bet $10,000.
Mm-hmm. No, that was a great gate. I remember they were really great gates.
The 622 is the successor to that.
Really? Interesting.
And what we're listening to right now on our voices is the circuit that is in the 622.
Okay. Well, obviously,
part and that's of why you're not hearing any chattering, by the way.
Bobby, let me ask you on the SSL boards. Were the gates good on the boards?
Very nice. Yeah, they're very, very quick, very fast. You could sidechain them, but not a great deal of, like, you were talking to the 612, and I used to like the Drama 201s. Remember the Drama gates?
Yeah.
What they had was that you could do was you could put EQ on the front end. You can do that on the SSL well.
That's on the sidechain.
That's the sidechain.
That's the key input.
The key input. You can choose what the gate opens. So, for example, if you've got a snare drum And the guy's hitting the snare drum, and he's obviously, you've mic'd it up, and it's next to a hi-hat, and he's playing hi-hat. But you only want to get it when he's, when the snare drum is hit, not hit the hi-hat. You can actually choose the threshold to ignore high frequencies, so it won't open when it hears the hi-hat.
Pretty
that
cool.
sort of thing.
That's cool.
That sort of thing. And also there's a good feature called ducking on gates, which is basically the opposite to it, and you can use that for compression, which is a very cool thing to do too, but anyway, where you actually switch a gate. A gate will open when the signal comes normally, but you can, good gates have a button on it most times where you can actually switch it from, instead of opening when the sound comes, close when the sound comes. You think, well, what's the use of that? But obviously, if you think about it, there's a lot of good uses for it. Like, for example, I don't know, switching off something when something else is playing, or...
Or even an announcer talking over music and right. wanting the music to right. duck down under.
Right. In a musical situation, it's kind of nice when you have, like, you know, 4/4 kick drum and your guy's playing a snare drum. But every time he hits the snare drum, you want it to reduce the kick drum by about half a dB, or reduce the bottom end on the kick drum by just on those beats. And that's a really easy way to get that job done without sitting there going and automating it.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because I think a lot of these tools that we're talking about, a lot of the techniques are being lost with the plugin world that we
lost.
Are.
Completely
and,
lost.
And you listen to some of that great music from the 70s where they're using all these tools and they're using them properly. And you're wondering, wow, how do they get that dynamic range? And why is that mix so clear? And now you've got mixes that are coming out of Pro Tools with guys that don't even know what an expander is from.
You don't have to, you know, I agree with that. I believe the art of recording is long gone, and the artistic value of a recording engineer and the character of a recording engineer is long gone. But I still think there's great records and great songs, and you don't have to know anything to do a great job. So, I don't stump a nose. What you said more importantly is the great music of the 70s. If the music got better, I'd be real happy. I wouldn't care what they recorded it on.
Yeah.
But there's definitely, you know what though? There's definitely some value in learning some of the tools that we're talking about. Even if you only have it in software form, you know, if you're on your Pro Tools, yeah. I mean, learn how to use the gate that's in Pro Tools. You learn how to use the compressor.
Oh, it's completely functional. I mean, even the gates that come with Pro Tools are completely functional and, if you learn them, it's still way better than not having a gate, obviously.
I think it's really, you know, coming from a songwriter's point of view, it's great to learn a few of these things, because it helps you with production. You start to think about how a song can come through, and even if you don't use a gate, you understand the principle of it, and that actually psychologically makes you think about how you record the songs, you know.
Well, and there are songs where, like, the gate becomes a major musical instrument. One of the most popular ones that people probably know is the song Crazy from Seal. That intro sound, that's that cool, weird, sequency sounding pattern, is actually a keyboard pad of some sort being played through a gate, but then the gate being opened and closed from its sidechain input by some sort of rhythmic performance.
That was a very
drum machine.
Popular style. They used to get a drummer come in and play a cowbell in the old days, in the 80s.
We just gave away a huge secret.
What's very interesting is a lot of gates by described that opening, if it's too fast an attack, you get a click. And one of the things that's a real benefit is to put that click on a snare to get more attack. And one of the knocks on our box was that you didn't get a click. And so people asked us to put a DC offset in there to actually create
a
click.
Pop, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, hey, guys, this has been a great, great, informative podcast, and I've learned a lot. And I think, you know, like we were saying, if people just use the tools that they have with them and just learn them really well, it'll help them in the songwriting. So,
learn to use them the wrong way, that's what I say.
Yeah, exactly.
Read the manual, then go, okay, how can I ruin and just see what I can do with this? That's where you come up with fun.
Mm-hmm. You're right. All right, well, Bobby, it's good to have you back.
Nice to be back, mates. Is. Thank you.
And we'll see you with the next podcast, right?
Absolutely,
because
mate.
Because the next podcast, just want to let everybody know, is our one-year anniversary. And it's going to be special. So that's all I'm going to say, is it's going to be a special podcast. So just be looking for that 1 year anniversary podcast. And I know all you guys will be here, right?
At
the
1 year. I think so.
And Marvin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Actually, yeah, definitely. Check. Do you still make those 612s, by the way?
No.
Oh.
But you could go to aphex.com if you want to find out any more information on some of the gear that Marvin talked about. And Rob?
Yes.
Any fun and exciting things that you're talking about?
That I can talk about?
Nope. Your furniture's going to be.
Well,
coming
the furniture is in the works, and
never had furniture ever in his life before.
No, well,
in his house or nothing.
I've never had this much furniture custom built at once before, and it's just I'm excited to see it. But I have to on a daily basis. I just try to not think about it because I walk into the studio and everything is kind of sitting there poised to be put into some new furniture that doesn't exist yet. So one of these weeks I'll have something to report.
All right. Well, when that gets up, we're going to get some pictures up so that everybody can see that. See the great job that KK Audio did.
Yeah, they're working hard.
And Pagey Boy?
Are you talking to me? I'm good. I'm involved at last. I only took 3 hours. Oh. It took 3 hours. Listening to stuff I don't understand.
Hey, weren't you on a here on an ASCAP panel recently?
Yeah, I was. I was at the expo last week. Actually, I think it was like 4 days for all the songwriters. It was an amazing conference because there was like 1,400 people there. I was involved with some songwriting panels, and the response was amazing. I mean. That it's alive and well, the creativity for songwriters out there. And I was actually doing one-on-one sort of panels where I would listen to people's songs, and there was some stunning stuff out there. So it was great, and able to spread the word that the album is nearly out. So it was a good week.
Well, hey, thanks for joining us on the Audio Nowcast. And don't forget, guys, next podcast, 1 year anniversary show. So if you guys have any questions and for any of the guys on the panel and even for Marvin, you can always email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. audio@nowcastnetwork.com. All right, well, we'll see you next time, and take it easy.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.